or 5 if you're unsure. Major changes occurring in my department and line of businesses are clearly aligned with transformation goals. Got approximately 77 responses. 10 seconds to go. Polling is closed. 36% say sometimes, followed by 25% rarely. Thank you again for your open and honest feedback. I believe the success of many transformation initiatives will require collaboration and joint ownership across multiple lines of businesses. 1 if you strongly agree, 2 if you agree, 3 if you're unsure, 4 if you disagree, and 5 if you strongly disagree. I believe the success of many transformation initiatives will require collaboration and joint ownership across multiple lines of businesses. You've got about 5 seconds left to vote. And polling is closed. And the results are 50% strongly agree, followed by 36% that agree. Thank you very much. I understand how my role will contribute to PG&E's transformation success. 1 for yes, 2 for no, 3 for sometimes, or 4 if you're still unsure. We've got about 10 seconds, approximately 90 folks voting. Polling is going to be closed. 50% say yes, followed by 27% sometimes. Thank you. Okay, Peter?
Okay, could we move to the next slide, please? So we wanted to give a little breakdown on how we're doing to date, and what we have here are some of the metrics. I've got to be careful not to get too close to that speaker. Some of the metrics that we use as to evaluate how we're doing. And if you take a look at overall, what you see up here is you have these pyramids here are diamonds that indicate what the 04 actual was. Here's the 05 actual, and then the target for what we seek to accomplish by 2006. What you see here is overall customer satisfaction. We didn't have a 04 goal. I think it is actually that one. We're looking at 1.0 in 04. We're at target actual. Actually, this line, I can't understand that. Looks like a blue goal, but I don't see the actual on that. Coming down to employee opinion, our goal for 04, as an example, we were at 60. The actual in 05 was 64%, and the target at the end of the year is 68. When you look across all of the data, what you see is for across 38 metrics, we have about 35 reporting currently. For about 17 or more of the measures, we are on target or ahead of target. What we expect is for the vast majority, by the end of the year, we will be at or ahead of target. There are probably about 6 or 7 where we are behind target. Donna, would you be in a position to comment about how Diablo Canyon is doing with some of its specific measures?
So one of the measures we also have is the Diablo Canyon Performance Index. And that's what we use for our IMPO Composite Index. So remember, that's a roll-up of several different measures. So what's the kind of things you see in that? Well, that's things like unit capability factor. So are we producing the electricity we should produce? It's got things like our collective rad exposure. It's got an industrial safety point. It's got safety system availability, so emergency diesel generators, ox feed water, safety injection. So they're the measures that we use across all of the industry to compare plants against each other. And so if we look at the numbers, they're showing 98.2. So let me tell you this and see what you think. Right now we're at 97.6, and that's the highest we've been since 2000. And you say, well, wait a minute, that's not what it says up there. But first, it is the highest we've been in over 5 to 6 years. And I want to tell you that I appreciate what everybody's done, because I look around the room and I've seen operators in here today, and it's how we've operated and controlled the plant that has helped us get there, because we've been able to operate safely, right? I see maintenance workers in here as well, and I want to thank the folks from maintenance, because it's how we keep our equipment running and the maintenance that you perform that keeps the plant running. So it's about safety and reliability. So we are in a comparison to the rest of the industry scores. What happened at the end of 2005 is we changed what those industry scores were. And so if we would have just been at the same level, our numbers would have been much higher. But they reset the goals. So by resetting the goals, the quartiles or our comparison data dropped by over 5 points in the industry, where our data actually has gone up. So by good reliability, breaker-to-breaker runs, executing outages on time, coming in with excellent ELARA performance, so collective dose has been below. Those types of things have been ahead of what the industry's doing, and that's really what's gotten us ahead. So that's what that indicator is all about.
Thank you, Donna. Can we go to the next slide? Okay. So we want to talk about the journey ahead, what you can expect from transformation in the future. Where we stand is that we've done a lot of work on the vision. People are getting familiar with the vision, understanding it, and becoming aligned around it. As Tom and I have looked at the pace at which we've been moving on transformation, the conclusion has been that we've moved at good speed, but we'd like to accelerate the speed and make it more rapid. And so we're looking at the different ways that we can speed up the transformation within the company. There's been significant engagement, and as we move forward, what we're doing around the engagement question is looking at how we can have more cultural workshops with more people. So those workshops that we have been doing and that many of the management members have been through, we're going to extend out and get to the extended leadership team during the next 12 months. And then what we are looking at is, should we condense those cultural workshops from 2 or 3 days into a shorter period, and then have every employee in the company go through those during the next year or two. And thus far, as I discussed, we're making good progress with our goals. I don't think we're going to hit all of them, but we're going to hit a good majority of them, and we have a few more that we have to get online in terms of reporting. Next slide. One of the things I always want to do in each meeting is talk about the 6 business priorities that we have for the year. And specifically, we've been talking about transformation here, and that's been a 4-year program that we've been looking at. But we also need to set 1-year targets as to what we're focused on, and I'm sure you have them in Diablo as well. The first of those targets was to advance business transformation. We've talked a lot about that. Second one was to implement all new plants that we would own and operate, and then the remainder would be contracted for. So we look like we're in very good shape to get the new power that is required in order to maintain our reserve margins of 115%, or having a 15% excess supply in terms of what we anticipate we'll need. Investment in the infrastructure. We had been investing at $1.8 billion a year. We're now at a point where we've stepped that up to $2.5 billion a year. On average for the next 5 years, and we've gotten the CPUC, it looks like, to buy into that level of investment. Improving our reputation. Our reputation during the energy crisis was down at about the 35% approval rating. The last numbers I saw, we were at 65% and heading north. I expect that we'll be above 65% when the new numbers come in. To give you an idea, President Bush is at 35%. Gray Davis was about 35% or lower, actually, during the energy crisis. And Mayor Newsom in San Francisco is at 80%, a very positive rating. So 65% and moving north is a good place to be, and we've made a lot of progress in that respect. We want to continue that, and it's going to require all of your help in order to do that. Evaluate evolving energy. We've talked a fair amount about that, and I'm sure people will ask questions about trends in the industry and mergers and acquisitions. Short message there is we have put in place the people and infrastructure in order to do mergers and acquisitions. When the right opportunities arise, we'll strike. We'll strike with opportunities that look very much like PG&E. Electric and gas distribution, electric and gas transmission, rate-based generation. Those are the businesses we know, we like, we want to build on. We're not doing anything overseas. We're not doing things outside our industry. We might do a pipeline, but we already know that kind of business. So that's what we have in mind there. We're also going to have a team that's going to hit the beaches, much like Colin Powell in the first Iraqi war, and we're going to overdo it, the planning and the preparation, so we're sure to succeed, because a lot of mergers go wrong, as we know, and I don't want to be a part of that. I've seen too many failures along the way. We want to overplan for this one. Lastly, provide attractive returns. We're up very close to our 11.35% return on equity. In the future, our target is to meet and even potentially exceed our authorized rate of return. So that's where we stand with respect to the six objectives we do with respect to innovation, as an example, or with respect to achieving excellence and moving the ball in that direction. So it's good. The more we talk about them, the more we keep the issues top of mind, and we'll pursue our business consistently with our values. So I think we're ready for a pulse check.
Okay, this is our final pulse check for today. Which obstacle below needs the most focus if we're to achieve the full benefits from business transformation? 1, conflicting priorities. 2, lack of management support. 3, staff inability to adapt to change. 4, ineffective training. Or 5, unclear roles and responsibilities. Which obstacle below needs the most focus if we're to achieve the full benefits from business transformation? Okay, looks like we're up in the 80s. About 5 seconds left. And the polling is closed. 27% say conflicting priorities. And then the number one is lack of management support. Thank you. The cultural changes we are making are key to the future success of PG&E. 1 for yes, 2 for no, or 3 if you're unsure. The cultural changes we are making are key to the future success of PG&E. We've got 10 seconds left to vote. Okay, the polling will be closed. 69% say yes, followed by 26% for unsure. Thank you again for your honest feedback. Which of the following channels is the most effective source of information about PG&E's transformation journey for you? 1, if it's your direct supervisor. 2, if it's the transformation website. 3, if it's Transformation at Work newsletter. 4, for emails. 5, for internal rumors. 6, for Transformation Partner Network, also known as TPN, or 7, tailboards. Which channel is the most effective source of information? We have about 10 seconds. Less than 5 seconds to vote. Polling's closed. 65% say yes, with 35% no. Thank you so much. During the day that you've spent with us, how well have we met our values of acting with integrity and communicating openly and honestly? 1, for extremely well, 2, for moderately, or 3, for poorly? 10 seconds to vote. Over 90 have responded. Polling is closed. 60% say extremely well, with 37% moderately. Thank you very much for your feedback today. Before we start our question and answers, we're going to ask that each row pass their little clickers to the right, and we'll have my colleagues collect them in a little basket. And we're going to, after that, we'll start with our Q&A for Peter. We ask that you raise your hand, and my colleague, Sugar, will has another mic. We'll bring it to you. Please make sure you hold the mic up to your mouth and speak so that everyone can hear your question, because if you do this, nobody can hear what you're saying. So it's important that you keep it up to your close to your mouth so we can all hear you and get Peter's response. Anybody like to start us off? Thank you.
Sure. Peter, I don't know if you've ever heard the terminology, nuclear power, too cheap to meter, years ago, right? Some of those utilities that you brought up earlier today, the leaders in the industry, they're already promoting the development of more nuclear power. So my question to you, do you have the courage, and does the rest of the board have the courage, to do what it takes to compete with those utilities, building more nuclear power, especially in this state where it could be particularly challenging?
The way I look at it is not first from the standpoint of courage. The way I look at it first is what's the smartest thing we can do for our company and for our customers? And the thought that I have in that respect is that there is twofold. First, currently it's illegal to build publicly, and we'll continue to state that publicly. Therefore, what I've said to Jack Keenan and to Tom King is I'd like you to evaluate the different nuclear options available to us and then come back and report to me. I believe that it is quite possible that the optimal recommendation that they make is that we would partner with a potentially out-of-state utility and build a plant on a site that's already been licensed but unbuilt upon, and we would have a local partner who was resident in that state, and we would be with two or three others that would join. So as I look at the question, I'm not so, you know, I don't use courage as the first criteria. Now, it may be the fact that we conclude that out-of-state is the right way to go, and that will take courage and determination to pursue it, because I think it will take at least 10 years before we move. If we concluded that the right thing for us was to build it here in California and to do that, if we concluded with that, I believe I have the courage to follow through. In the course of the bankruptcy, we went through just about every possible wormhole you could put a management team in, and there were about 40 people that were directly involved in managing the bankruptcy process. And some people say that the most critical person in a bankruptcy process is not even the CEO, it's the CFO. And so I think that that was a pretty good opportunity to test the CFO at that time. So I'm confident that, you know, if the question get called, that the senior management and I will have the courage to do the right thing. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Okay. There's a question back here.
Hi. Thanks for coming. It's really great to have the CEO here. There was one slide that you showed, and you were talking about what we're doing for transformation and where we're investing. And it was a great, I think it was, we're going to $2.5 billion toward infrastructure. And that's a big number. And while I'm sure no one would argue that we need to beef up our infrastructure, I was wondering where, A, are the funds coming from to pay that? Are we borrowing from that? Are we getting the ratepayers to pay? And B, what kind of impact do you see that
charge? Which is, I don't know, $1.4 billion. That gets us up to about $2 billion. We take that. As we look at some of our peak demands, what we have communicated is that we might use ongoing sources of equity that we would raise through like a dividend reinvestment program or the equity that we raise through 401k, which are devices we've used in the past. And we would combine that with some debt financing, but keep our capital structure the same with about, 52% equity currently. So we used internally generated equity plus some additional debt And on that basis, we feel that we can make it through the peak capital demand years that we're faced with. If you look at some years, we actually have a shortfall of equity, but we think we can bridge that with the ongoing sources, and we might even borrow a little in the holding company and infuse it into the utility to be at our 52% equity ratio. Now, as that relates to dividends, we've set a payout ratio of 50 to 70%. We've been at the low end of that ratio at about 53%. And what I've communicated to the investment community is while we have these peak demands in terms of growing the business, that we'll keep within 50 to 70% range, but we'll be at the low end of that range. So it's likely that it will continue to increase, but not at an accelerating rate in the foreseeable future. Okay? Other questions? Come on, guys. Yep.
Our stock prices are soaring. What's your prediction on are they going to continue to go up? What are we doing to make them soar?
Okay. I never predict stock price. When I worked on Wall Street, I had a computer right in front of me back when computers weren't that prevalent. And one of the things when I first joined Wall Street, my boss said to me, never, ever predict stock prices or interest rates for your customers, because you're going to be wrong about 50% of the time, and you're going to regret it. He said, if you were so good that you could predict stock prices and interest rates, you'd be on an island with your 150-foot yacht and having a good time. Now, that said, what I'll talk about is some of the factors that explain our share price and what you can expect going forward. The first thing is our share price is sort of close to an all-time high. So we should all feel very good about that, particularly from where it came from, which was about $6 and change during the depths of the energy crisis. So that's the first thought. The reason that it is doing so well is largely a result of the deal we were able to strike with the state on the bankruptcy settlement, where we got recovery of a lot of the amounts we were due, where we paid for energy, but customers hadn't paid us. And we were out $6 billion, and so we were able to leverage ourselves into a situation where we got a deal with the state for recovery of that $6 billion. The key driver behind our current share price is the earnings we create, we generate every year, and the earnings per share, and those are very, very strong now and are projected to continue to be strong because of the new capital investment we're making in the company, the $2.5 billion per year. The other major factor that contributes to how well we're doing is, of course, the dividend, but importantly also, we have a very good relationship with our CPUC, and so people feel that it's likely that the earnings will actually materialize as most analysts have forecasted them. So those are the drivers that would explain our current share price and where we expect it to go in the future. Now, let me tell you about the wild cards in that respect. The sector of utilities is at unprecedentedly high levels. The stock market is at a pretty high level, but not, you know, unprecedentedly so. So the factors that might impact on the sector would be a significant increase in interest rates. And what happens is utility stocks go down if they pay a dividend. They tend to go down if interest rates go up. So that factor, which is a material risk because they're inflationary pressures out there in the economy right now, that factor could cause the whole sector to go down and we'd go down with it. The other question is what's going to happen in the stock market, and certainly any major terrorist attacks and problems, instability could cause the whole market to go down and we might go down as well, although we are known as a bit of a haven for security among investments as opposed to high tech or international, so that could have an offsetting factor. So there are a lot of factors, but I think what I've done is tried to identify the major factors. What I wouldn't expect is in the immediate future, you know, we're going to run $20 more per share because we're sort of at the high end of our historical range. Is that helpful?
Yep.
Good. Okay. Another question.
We have some questions from the kiosk. Kathy, I know you have a couple.
Yes.
You want to go ahead?
The first question, Peter, is How do I communicate with my friends and neighbors about the huge bonuses that the officers received?
Good. Okay. couple of points here first. There are a couple of different bonus payments that the public and some employees got very upset about. So let me walk you through the different bonus payments. Right before we went into bankruptcy, the Chronicle reported, you know, bonuses paid and all of that to PG&E executives. It wasn't really PG&E executives that those bonuses were paid for. In fact, the PG&E executives didn't receive any bonus at that time. What it was there was the PIP and STIP payments, and those were paid out at that time, and Bob Glenn made the decision. The employees worked hard, they deserved it, we're going to pay that. But he specifically excluded the senior management of the company, so I think it was... I think all officers, I know senior vice presidents didn't get it. I think vice presidents and senior vice presidents above did not get bonuses at that time. What I want to say is there was this huge explosion over the issue, but it was actually, I think, like 1,100 people or whatever got the bonuses at that time, but they weren't senior management. So the world thinks it was senior management, and the newspapers didn't make that clear, and we tried to communicate it to them, but they didn't want to print that story. And so it was... a lot of people here, like directors and managers, that got those bonuses, senior management did not. Now, the most problematic, you know, bonuses that were paid, and the largest bonuses that were paid were called the retention bonuses, okay? On this topic, what you're going to hear, I'll explain to you the thinking of the board of directors, and what I'm going to say is you may disagree with this or you may agree with it. In the end, what I have found is this is a topic on which reasonable people can disagree. And frankly, it's probably split about 50-50. Okay? So let me explain what it is. At the time that the company was heading into bankruptcy, the board of directors didn't know much about bankruptcy, nor did Bob Glenn. And so what he and the board did was they went out and talked to a number of experts as well as people at other companies and said, what is it that we should do? You know, what are the 10 or 15 things you should do? Among those, people said, it's very important that you retain your senior management of the company. And in most cases, the senior management leaves and they just disappear. Because they don't think there's going to be a company there. They think they're going to get fired by the creditors and they just take off. Okay. The board of directors, Bob Glenn, and Brent Stanley were the people involved in that decision, no other members of management, and no other members were even aware of it. And what they concluded was it made sense to put in place retention bonuses. Okay. At the time that they were put in place, the stock was, I think, about $10. The stock then went down to about $6.50. Okay. What happened then was they went into place. And then we went through a lot of machinations, you'll remember, over the period of time. And the company put together an incredible plan of reorganization that the state, it had two factors associated with it. One, it was very, very credible in that the state was scared to death that we would win in court with that. The second thing is it created huge value for the shareholders by separating the company into component parts that had a lot of value. We predicted that the value of that plan was $40 a share. And we did that when the stock was like $6. And so what happened was the state ultimately was driven to a negotiation with management, and we came out with a plan that we have today, which, oh, by the way, brought the stock to about $40, about the same place. The reaction of the share price was much more rapid, and the whole recovery process was faster than most people thought. So at the time that the board made the grant, because the grant was made before we even had a plan of reorganization, nobody thought that the stock was going to be at $40 or $30. The reaction was, we put together the plan, we won with the state, the stock went up and was at about 28 or 30 when it paid out And that means that the stock was 2.5 times higher, 250% higher than at the time they put in the plan. So the payouts under the plan were much larger. Now, when you look up the aggregate size of the stock compared to the market value of the company, it was about 1.25%. It was about $80 million, something like that. So what happens is if you go to some people and you say, you know, Bob Glenn got paid a lot of money, I think, you know, between stocks and options, it was like $20 million. Some people say that's outrageous, and how could he have made money from that like that? If you go to the shareholders, particularly those that are expert in bankruptcy, they say that was ridiculously small. They say a lot of CEOs are paid $20 million just to liquidate a company. You guys not only saved the company, paid the creditors in full, but returned the company to a $40 share value. We think that that was a small price to pay. Portfolio managers get paid 1.25% to manage money. So that's the story. Some people think it's awful. Some people think it's reasonable. What I find is if people who feel, they look at things and say that's fair or unfair, they think it's unfair because it's a large amount of money. People who look at what are market comparables, what is the standard thing that people do in bankruptcy processes and all, they say it was very usual, it was actually kind of a small payment relative to what was done. So those are the facts, and you can make the judgments for yourself, but that was the rationale behind it. Okay? Yes, sir.
So, I mean, I believe that story, and I think it's a very credible story.
Okay.
So my question to you is, if one of our goals is open and honest communication, why did it take us 2.5 years to tell us that story?
Because I wasn't CEO at the time, and Bob, in all seriousness, Bob, he and I had screaming matches in his office about our communication strategy. And he said, you're wrong, and we shouldn't do that. I've embarked on an entirely different communication strategy, and I believe that I'm proving, and we're proving, that it's right by just being very open and honest, telling people the facts. And I disagreed with him, and frankly, I'm amazed he kept me on as a CFO, and I'm even more amazed that he was able to say, and you ought to be the CEO of the company and my successor. I got to respect the guy for that, because I really hit him with it and said, I think you're making a huge mistake.
Okay, we have another question. How many employees did you solicit feedback from to find out what energizes employees?
As we talked as a group about that question among the senior management team, so probably 15 or 20, I've seen that question come up in the course of these discussions, and the thought process that I've had is that we'd actually like to create a very substantial effort to gather people's input on what they feel energizes them. And so in answer to the question, a small group to date, but what I'd like to do is expand that to a very large group and ask have people give us their ideas about what energizes people. I'll tell you my answer to the question, but I'm open to others, and that is that you need to have a vision first that's aspirational, and it can't be we make our budget or we work for the shareholder. It has to be something about, I think, doing good, and so the idea of really doing a great job for our customers, the idea of taking a strong stance on the climate as we have, to take care of our planet, the idea of taking care of our community, which is all of this is baked in our values, the idea of people enjoying coming to work, providing input and their input being taken and incorporated and them getting feedback about their idea was either accepted or rejected and why. These are the things that I believe create energized employees and that we all need to work on to accomplish it.
I have another question. How can the worst manager be one of the highest paid executives in the U.S.? I think it's referring to a Forbes magazine article.
Okay. I
who? Your predecessor,
maybe that there was a Business Week article that said he was the worst CEO. Okay. So there are two kind of issues here. One, how was he paid so much? And two, he was awful, right?
That is pretty much it.
Okay. I think Forbes may have gone to the compensation, and I know there was an article in Business Week about how he was the worst CEO around. There are probably 10 people that really saw what happened in the energy crisis that were right there, eyeball to eyeball with Gray Davis. And Bob Glenn and myself were one. There were, Dan Richard was another. Roger Peters was another. Those were the four from our team. John Bryson was another chairman of Edison. His CFO, Ted Craver, who I spoke with six times a day during that period of time, was another. Gray Davis was one. Mike Peavy was another. Michael Kahn was a third. Loretta Lynch was another. So there were only like 10 people or 12 people who really saw it all at that time. I hope I've been pretty even-handed with Bob in my characterization of him. I haven't said that the guy has been all great or all bad. What I'll tell you is, boy, I certainly disagreed with his communication strategy. I told him then, and I'll tell people afterwards. What I don't think most people realize here is how much we have to owe to the guy about how he played poker in that situation, and it was very high-stakes poker. The entire company, just about, was saying settle and settle with the state under any basis. And that guy had the courage with, you know, the vote even within the company of about 19,000, you know, 950 to hold off and wait till we had just absolutely the right time to do the deal. And I'll tell you, I couldn't have done as good a job even though I was a deal maker on Wall Street. And I'll tell you, when it really got tough for him was one January night. I was viewed as his sort of war advisor. I was one of the most aggressive and hawkish on the team as opposed to the rest of the team that were dubs. In January of 2000, I forget the year now, would be like 3 or something like that, I went to him 7 o'clock at night in his office, and I said, Bob, we're getting hammered by the institutional investors, by everyone. They were literally screaming at the phone at me, you know, settle. And I assessed everything, and I said, Bob, I think the time has come. I think we need to settle with the state. The pressures are too great. The what's at risk is too great. We need to settle. And he looked at me sort of like his last friend in the room. And for those of you who remember Julius Caesar, after he was stabbed by Brutus, he said, et tu, Brute, which was, and you, Brutus. And that's the look Bob gave me, like my last friend has finally come out and is pulling support from under me on the strategy. And that guy, to his credit, went another 2 months, picked the most ideal time to negotiate with the state and got us a really great deal. Now, you may not think it was such a great deal, but think about it. The creditors got paid 100 cents on the dollar. They got paid interest. We didn't fire all sorts of employees. Everybody got paid. The lights remained on. The company came out of bankruptcy and was immediately investment grade. We are just short of A-rated investment grade today. Our relations with the commission are better than ever. All of these things, really, for people that are experts in bankruptcy, truly extraordinary. So what I'm telling you is when we called the guy at Business Week and said, you got it wrong, the guy didn't want to listen to any of this. He said, you got a bankruptcy, you bankrupt utility, bankrupt NEG, defaulted parent company, the guy has to be the worst. And for he was only looking at a couple of facts. The second thing, in terms of his compensation, I think that I've answered that already, in that when you look at, you talk to Merity Moore, a workout specialist at Watershed, you talk to the people at Fairlawn, you talk to others, they say it was a stupendous deal and he got paid a fair bonus. So That's what I'd say on the topic. You may not agree, and you know, but I'll just give you my best answer as to what I think on the topic. I think we have time for one more question.
Earlier you mentioned about a phone number, or we should, to get involved for our friends, neighbors, customers, whatever, if they have a problem. What phone number do we call?
I think, first of all, I'd like to identify a number in the company that where we can call. But what I would suggest is you ask your supervisor or other people here, and then what they, if they don't have a number for you to call, like the customer service number, something like that, then they should know somebody in the company that would be the right contact. Short of that, call Helen Burt's office. She's the Senior Vice President of Customer Care, and I think her assistant can get you pointed in the right direction. But with persistence and tenacity, I'm sure we can answer that question. Okay.
And a mic appears. So with that question, Jim Becker and I got talking about that, and we asked some folks about what would be the most convenient for people to have, and what we're hearing is some type of card you could put in a billfold or wallet. And so something you could refer to that would have contacts, like a name and a number. So that's what we're putting together, and we're going to get that out to all employees so you'll have something to refer to. A question came up in one of the sessions where I was talking about it, and I'm glad they brought that up because the comment was made, well, is it going to be a person or some phone tree where you have to go through a bunch of computerized choices? So I'm going to find out about that. So we'll know that when we hand it off what kind of contact somebody's going to get, and we want to try to get them to somebody that can answer that question. And we're going to try those cards and give me feedback. If it works, great. If there's something else we need to do with that, we'll make some adjustments and try something else.
Thanks, Donna, for making it efficient and effective and easy for you guys to help out. Good. I think we're now ready to go to the video.
Officers and directors and very high-level people at the company all united in what we're trying to accomplish. And that's a lot different than with past initiatives. And I've seen them take a step back and say, hey, you know what, maybe these people have a little more detailed knowledge about what we're talking about here. Those kinds of things buy them a lot of credibility. And I'm encouraged by seeing stuff like that.
The company has demonstrated a couple of times with the way they're dealing with their unions, particularly the IBEW and the agreements that they've come up with regarding transformation, that they're showing a genuine interest in their employees, which is not something you find everywhere these days.
Transformation, for me, it's like one of the first times in the 15 years I've worked for the company where I actually feel like part of the bigger company and not just part of Diablo Canyon.
I'm very confident that we will succeed with transformation. Given the team that we've built, the progress we've been making, as well as the feedback, we have to have among our expectations that there are going to be bumps in the road, there are going to be setbacks. And that doesn't represent failure. That represents what we expect. And our job is to overcome those obstacles and succeed with transformation.
Every one of us has a customer service responsibility. Every one of us has a responsibility to represent PG&E and to deal with customers differently.
And you can't be afraid to tell your superior or his superior that you don't think it's working. And, you know, don't go in with the attitude of this is stupid and we're not doing it, but have a plan of why you're doing it, why you don't think it's going to work.
Pull your folks together and have face-to-face meetings. Don't hide behind your computer. Don't just send out lots of emails. Pull them together and have meetings. Give them an opportunity to look you in the eye and to see that you are concerned about not only your own future, but you're concerned about their future too.
What was amazing to me is even though I've only been here 8 years, the speed at which things have been done this last year and a half, amazing. Changes all over the place. I've seen VPs talk that I've only heard names of. I've actually seen them walking around and talking to people.
I mean, we're the best state in the union. We're in California. We're leading, one of the leading states. I mean, if, we should be the leading utility, too.
Do you want that sense of pride where you walk on and, you, and somebody asks you, who do you work for? PG&E. And you're sitting in the middle of New York or Manhattan, and everybody goes, oh, yeah, I know that company. That's what you want, and that's what I would like to see.
It's like a dream, what they want to accomplish, and I see them going in that direction in several areas. The open communication, lines of communication, I think are totally different than they've ever been.
I look forward to coming to work. That's the truth. I look forward to my day here. The day goes by very fast for me, but I look forward to it. I have not regretted coming in here, not one day.
We have a question in front of us. What is each of us, what is our role going to be with transformation? For the cynic, it's going to be, I'm going to cross my arms, I'm going to look at this, make sarcastic remarks, and you know, kind of shrug my shoulders. For the most proactive people, they're going to learn everything they can about transformation and ask themselves, how can they help, how can they engage? I can assure you of one thing. If you're in the latter group where you're asking the question, what more can I do to become involved, you're going to be a happier, more fulfilled individual, and the people around you are going to feel better for your role among the team. So the choice is each of us in our own way here at Diablo, but also relative to our role with the larger PG&E. You have to ask yourself, what role are you going to play? I would ask you that you engage, you be fully engaged. Tom King, Peter Darby, the senior management team, can't do it by themselves. We need all of you, and I ask for your help, 20,000 men and women at PG&E, to make us the best utility, the leading utility in the United States. Thank you.